Hi, my name's Emily. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. I did something funny to my back earlier, so if I grimace, it's not because of you guys. I was taking a little break to sort of try to get myself prepared to speak tonight, and I have so much respect for this particular AA group, and I started getting myself into a little bit of a knot about what you guys might think of me, how I might sound, you know, and then I just thought, you know, it's really not about me up here, and I just hope that I can share something that maybe will help someone or, you know, make someone feel connected or something. So it's just, I really respect this group. It's a real honor to be here. Thanks for asking me. Those are my favorite Sundays when I get to ride up with my sponsor. It's a nice long car ride, and we talk on the way and then talk on the way back home. There's always a good speaker here. So my sobriety date is March 29th, 2009. So it's been a little over 3 years, and it feels like a lot has happened in that time. It feels like about 40 lifetimes have gone by. I think that's a good thing. better than 3 years going by where I don't really remember anything, which certainly happened too. And I'm touched today. It feels like it's a gift. And that's my sobriety date. I have a sponsor. She has a very exciting sponsor, a fun line of women that we are in fellowship with. And I go to a lot of AA meetings. I go to about 4 a week these days. And I have a home group. It's a Common Solution group. We meet in Charlottesville Thursday nights at 7:30. Currently, I am the greeter. That is my job. And I've held various service commitments over the years in corrections and some other areas. So I'm grateful to be here tonight. I'm really grateful to be sober. So I'm going to kick it off with what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. It seems really different than how it used to be. I grew up in Baltimore City, and I come from a parents that are still married, and I have a sister, and growing up with her was pretty interesting. She was bipolar, untreated for a long time. My dad's a pretty heavy drinker. I'm pretty convinced he's actually not an alcoholic as time goes by, but it's not really for me to decide. But he certainly drank a lot. My mom drinks, and when she has a drink, she'll have like one margarita, her face turns bright red, she starts laughing a lot, and then she falls asleep. So, you know, and she has, I'm just touched by my mom. She's so funny. The other day she was telling me she's in some sort of like committee, like some like volunteer government thing, and she was like, yeah, I really don't like it, but I'm committed, so I'm going to keep going, you know, every time they asked me to for the rest of the year. And I was like, why didn't you give me that gene? You know, I missed that gene. You know, if I don't like something that's not doing anything for me, I'm probably not going to do it. You know, that's just the way I'm wired. Alcoholics Anonymous has kind of steered me in a better direction, you know. But you know, that's she's a normal kind of a person. That's my home life. It was pretty chaotic at times, and but you know, that's really not why I'm an alcoholic. I remember times where I don't know, like one time my best friend moved away and she was coming back to visit, and I sat there and waited for 7 hours, you know, and I didn't move until she came. You know, I had some serious willpower going on back then. And you know, I'd wait things out, just kind of bullheaded about things. I would spend a lot of time by myself. I just felt like I was just sort of a little off the right track. Like, people would, even in school, like the teacher would ask a question, and kids would, like, seem to know the answer, and the answer that was in my head was, like, way in a different direction. You know, I just felt, like, really a misfit my whole life. And, you know, but I always tried to hide that because I felt like that was, I was doing something wrong. Or, so, and I would always make friends with, like, the other misfits and, you know, really, like, some weird kids, and I was one of them. And, you know, as time, I remember in middle school, we ended up moving up to Philadelphia, and I didn't like it at all. And I remember saying to myself, it's only 3 years, and I don't remember a day of that 3 years, you know. I just, like, muscled through it. And, you know, I just was always, like, real restless, you know, irritable and discontented. I can remember that from the very beginning, and I had no idea that was alcoholism. And I'd also have this, like, anxiety. Sometimes I'd go to kids' parties, and I would just get so anxious about, I don't remember what, and it's probably what they thought of me or the fear of not fitting in, and I would get really sick and end up spending the whole time in the bathroom. You know, that's just how it was. And, you know, I would just get, like, really, I don't know, just spend a lot of time by myself up in my head and not really, like, know how to, like, reach out to people or have friends, you know, that felt like friends. And, you know, so it was a miracle when I found alcohol. You know, at the age of 13, I remember just having two people over, and they were my friends, but I didn't really know how to relate to them, and I remember just, it just seemed like the right thing to go to my dad's liquor cabinet and pour myself a pretty big glass of rum and put some Coke into it. And I didn't tell anybody else I was having a drink. So I kind of stole and lied from the beginning. And, you know, I don't think I ever had social drinking after that. You know, and it seemed like talking to my friends became so much easier and being with them, and I cared less about what they were thinking, so I decided to pour myself another one and another one. And by the time my parents got home, I couldn't really, like, see straight. And I remember my friend turned to me, he said, "Are you drunk? Like, what just happened?" And I said, "Absolutely not." You know, and I don't know, it just seemed like I felt normal for the first time. You know, I could take a deep breath. And just, you know, all that outside stuff didn't really touch me so much, or didn't bother me so much, you know, and that's really what alcohol did for me. But I didn't know it, you know. It didn't make that kind of sense then. And I grew up in a pretty straight-laced environment at that time, so I would steal my dad's alcohol and fill up the bottles with water. And, you know, somebody who likes to drink a lot doesn't like watered-down alcohol. And so I would get in trouble over that, and so I had to find another way, and we would find fake IDs and go to the liquor store. And it was, like, hard to get a hold of alcohol at that time, you know, and at that time I wasn't willing to do as many things to get it. So I definitely smoked a lot of marijuana and hated it. I really didn't like what it did for me. But, you know, those were the people I was hanging out with. That was where I was, and I'm sure at parties when there was alcohol available, that's where I was. And I just loved what it did for me. You know, I just felt, I was, like, always just all tied up in knots, you know, and when I was at parties and drinking, it just didn't feel like life was so hard. And so high school was unremarkable. I went to art school in Baltimore City, back in Baltimore City, and I think art schools, you don't really go there for the academics. Like, I definitely, looking back, a big part of that choice was the lifestyle that came along with it. A lot of warehouse parties. You know, and in Baltimore City, and looking back, there's so many experiences of, like, you know, that just seemed so normal at the time. I would go to keg parties, and I would pay my $5, go to the keg, not talk to anybody, fill up my beer, drink it, fill it up, drink it, fill it up, drink it. And the party hosters would get really mad. They're like, you know, it's really for everyone, you know. And, you know, I would just get what I wanted and then leave, really. It's not normal. And, you know, and I would get really drunk sometimes, and I'd end up with people, like, you know, drunk, stumbling down alleyways in Baltimore City, which is not, you know, if I had kids today, I wouldn't want them doing that. So I don't remember a whole lot about college as well. That's kind of how it went. There was a bar on campus. I spent a lot of time in there. You could find a lot of the professors in there. That's where their office hours were. And that was great. It was really great. And, you know, really in college, I didn't have a lot of money. And I, at this point, you know, I wasn't, when my sister had been pretty sick, I had really checked out from my family. Once I got the car keys, they didn't really see me again for a long time. And, you know, I wasn't in college. I just remember the only time I'd ever call them was to, like, ask for money. Not even ask, demand money, you know, to spend how I wanted to spend it. My mom would always give me money to fly out to Chicago to see my grandma, and I would always spend it on what I wanted to spend it on, which was usually at the bar. And I'd be, like, buying drinks for other people, which seems ridiculous at the time, looking back. So, I don't know. I get exhausted thinking about all the places and all the things, you know. And then I found boats. I started working on boats in Baltimore City. Almost dropped out of school in the last semester so I could go hang out with sailors. I ended up moving down there. I loved it because sailors, it seemed like drinking was the job, you know. Sailing was like the activity that sort of went around the drinking, but really, like, people drank on the job, they drank before the job, they drank after the job, and we would all do it together, so it felt like normal, you know. And I lived in this apartment where the ceiling was falling in. You know, I love those people that come into AA with the stories of having lost a lot of things. I'm the kind of person that never really built anything in my life, you know. I just didn't have a lot to show for the 29 years when I got here, 28 years. And I did that until that lifestyle caught up with me. I'd been getting into a lot of bar fights at the time. And I know I look like a nice young lady. and I used to say that, you know. I would, people would say, God, you are really a, you know. And I'd say, I am a nice young lady. And then I'd punch somebody, you know. And I couldn't understand why they would call me those names. you know, and I think it's been through a lot of time in AA and inventory and talking to my sponsor that, you know, I can look back and see that I was a terrified, terrified little girl. And the only way I knew how to, like, not get hurt or not be scared was to drink a lot and act really tough. And I really wanted to be that person that didn't care. And, you know, I thought I would grow up and be like, I really think I believe this, that I would be like a pirate or a cowboy when I grew up. You know, like one of those people with those lifestyles that could just kind of drift from place to place. And I had those friends that were sailors. They would live on their boats. They would, like, live in the Caribbean half of the year. And that just seemed like paradise to me. And that didn't really work out that well. I got involved with this person who was involved with another person, and it got a little scary. And, you know, he asked me to run away with him, and I'm like 22 at this time, to run away with him to the Caribbean. And I feel like this is a moment my first sponsor said, God was doing for you what you couldn't do for yourself. And I was like, you know, I just couldn't understand what she was talking about, and now I think I see what she means. But, you know, I just had this inside sense that that wasn't the right thing to do, that I might end up like some homeless, toothless, you know. I just had this vision of how that was going to go. And somehow I got, like, plucked out of that lifestyle, got a job at, like, Johns Hopkins and an apartment, you know. But that kind of drinking was where I was drinking, like, every night, stumbling in the streets of Baltimore with people I didn't know, getting in really bad situations with men, women fights, you know. And showing up to work on tourist boats with children, you know, drunk, and bringing people airplane bottles. And that was really shameful living, and it scared me a lot. And so I spent the next year not drinking. And what that looked like for me is crying every night. I had a friend move in with me, and he was like, what on earth has happened to you, you know? Why can't you just lighten up, you know? Why are you so sad all the time? And the truth is I was sober, you know, and not, you know, not being able to live my life. And I just couldn't live life sober. It was really unpleasant for me. You know, the magic of a couple drinks, you know, of a couple shots of Jameson neat, just a couple shots, and everything was okay. All my problems disappeared. I felt prettier. I felt friendlier, even though I was hitting people. You know, and when I would take that magic away by trying to control my drinking and not drink, my life would spin into this very lonely downward spiral, and I just didn't know how to live life sober. And I thought I had things like depression and anxiety, and I didn't know it was untreated alcoholism until I came here. And so, you know, and after enough time of that, I decided to, you know, go back to that party lifestyle. I worked at an ad agency. My job was to get beer to have at the job. And we would go out every single night. You know, I was good at picking jobs that And in my current job, they have two kegs all the time on tap that you can drink from any time. And I think if I'd had this job back then, I wouldn't have been there very long, but I would have enjoyed it. And so that was fun. You know, a lot of my drinking, it was like, I had a lot of fun. You know, I really loved drinking. I loved it. It was magic for me. And I think when people get up here and they can't, you know, they don't say that, I don't identify with that. You know, I drank for a reason. It was magic for me. It did a lot for me. It was really powerful for me. And I think that I don't know what the normal drinker experiences when they have a few drinks, you know, but I needed that kind of solution. And anyways, so I really bottomed out with my drinking again there, sort of alienated a lot of friends. And I had that experience where I felt like on every street corner in Baltimore, I just felt haunted by all the experiences, you know, all the bad things I'd done, all the fights I'd been in, all the people I'd slept with that I shouldn't have slept with, you know, all that's like real shameful. Like, I felt like I was always in a state of like cringe, you know, like I was always like cringing about some memory that was popping up. And it was miserable. And so, of course, Baltimore was a terrible place to live. So I moved down to Virginia, down here. My parents, I bought this farm. You know, and all along this time, I had no relationship with my family. You know, it showed up at my sister's wedding. My mom made her ask me to be the bridesmaid. And I showed up late and drunk and salty. You know, I was just cursing here and there. You know, I think my family was kind of worried. I was just viciously antisocial. And, you know, I had no relationship with my family, but my parents had bought this farm that they were going to retire on to. And I thought, oh, man, you know, that's an alcoholic's dream, you know, like in the middle of nowhere. I don't know a soul. I don't really have to have a job except to, you know, pay for food and alcohol and cigarettes, you know, and so I moved down here. I would turn my phone off for, like, weeks at a time, you know, like waiting for people to choose me, you know, or ask me to come back, and nobody did. And, you know, I lived in the basement of this farmhouse. There was, like, one folding chair. It was awful. You know, I just lived in the basement of this big, beautiful house. Nobody else lived there, and there I was tucked away under the stairs, you know, with the curtains drawn and thinking that that was normal living, you know, at the age of 22, 23. And when I think back at that, it seems really sad to me and really pathetic, you know, and when the neighbors would knock, I would hide behind the couch, you know. When the phone would ring, I'd pick it up and then hang it right back up again. I was always really in a weird spot. And I had this friend she was a friend that taught me how to drink Jameson neat, which I thought was so cool. And that's what I would always drink and ask for a double. And she had taught me how to drink that. We'd stayed in touch, and all along this time she'd gotten sober, and I found that really annoying. And, you know, we didn't really have much in common. And so she said, you know, you're starting to get really weird down there. You know, and what are you really doing down there anyhow? Why don't you come to New York City where everybody is? And I just knew in my heart I didn't have the power to do anything like that with my life. You know, I didn't really have power to do anything. And I was drinking at this time. You know, it wasn't one of these periods where I was stopped drinking. Like, I was drinking at this time. And I thought she was just telling me that I was lonely. So I decided to go back out to the bars. You know, I'd call it a say yes campaign. Say yes to anything. Stupid idea. that got me in some really dumb situations. But so I got involved in these bars out in the country. And, you know, my favorite bar was called The Reactor. And I just thought that was a great name for some heavy drinking. You know, it had like black walls, a black floor, a black ceiling. And it had my kind of people. And it was such a great bar. And, you know, I got into, like, all that stuff that I thought was just happening because I was young and, you know, whatever, like, came back and worse. I was getting in really scary fights at this time, fights, you know, with, like, big dudes. And, you know, really chatting up some really scary dudes, you know, and taking, you know, I was just talking to somebody yesterday. I was friends with this girl. I don't know why she was friends with me. And I'd like demand that I stay at her house because she lived out there, take my dog, even though she had a cat and I had a Rottweiler. And, you know, I'd throw up all over her bathroom and she'd like clean it up and I'd be like, be quiet in there, you know, waking me up. And she'd be in there like cleaning up after me, you know. I remember making amends to her and she was really gracious about it. And she actually, I'm just remembering this, she gave me this little, like, she's very religious. I don't know what she was doing in the bars, but she gave me this little book that really helped me a lot. It was like some sort of spiritual daily, like, reader. You know, I really feel like God sort of put her in my life for a reason, too. And anyhow, so things got pretty hairy pretty fast. And I remember committing my last few months to my paycheck to drinking and thinking, maybe it's kind of weird, but I'm going to do it, you know? And I remember thinking, maybe I am drinking a lot, and maybe I should stop. And so I remember not drinking for a day and spending that whole day laying like this in my bed, like staring at the fridge, like muscling through to the next day when I knew I could drink, you know? And this one night I drank so much I was kind of paralyzed for like 12 hours. I don't know if that's ever happened to any of you. I was, like, paralyzed. I couldn't really move, and that really scared me, and I said, I'm not going to drink again. You know, 6 hours later, there I am at the bar, you know, and that night I had somebody in my car, you know, and decided to run my car into a tree, you know. I just didn't want to live like that anymore, and he, like, pulled us over the side of the road, and this poor man had a family and babies, and here I am trying to kill the both of us. And, I don't know, my friend who had gotten sober at this point was not taking my phone calls because she was sick of hearing about all the drama. And I don't know, you guys, like, I feel like I could have gone down that path for so much longer than I did. You know, at this point I was drinking before work some mornings because I couldn't really stay asleep all that long. Like, I would wake up after a couple hours, like, with that, like, racing brain, not able to, like, breathe. And, you know, drinking was... help me get back to sleep and help me get to work. And anyway, so that morning after that experience, I don't know. I like that part in Bill's story where he talks about that bottom that he hits. I mean, he did drink again after that, but like I identify with that kind of darkness, you know, of that waking up and just like nowhere to turn. And I just was terrified. You know, I just knew that, you know, after some time in AA, I remember, like, for a long time, I had not been turning on the lights in the bathroom. I didn't want to look at myself, you know? And I had been, like, looking at trees on the side of the highway, like, that's a big one, you know? It's not too much of a ditch, you know? I could run into that one, you know? And I've been doing that for a very long time. And I didn't know that until I came here and heard other people talking about that stuff. And, so I just had this impulse that morning to call my friend. I was desperate, you know, and for some reason she picked up the phone. And she said, you know, I've been trying to tell you for a while that I think you might have a problem with drinking, you know. I think you might want to go to a meeting. And I just was so offended, you know. I really just wanted her to, like, hear my problems and, like, feel bad for me. And, you know, that, like, window of willingness was closing really fast. I was like, well, I really need to walk my dog, and I need to take a shower, and I need to get something to eat. And, you know, I mean, I think last night really wasn't that bad, you know. And she said, please just shut up and go to a meeting. And she was in Louisville, Kentucky. She, like, looked up a meeting on the website and, you know, kind of guided me there. And it was that meeting, it's like some odd meeting that I've never been back to. It's based on the grapevine, and it's like on a Sunday. It's a beautiful Sunday. It was sunny outside. I don't know if you guys can identify with this, but I would like hate when it was sunny outside. I'd be like, because there'd be like people like running and stuff, and I would yell at them. You know, I was like really resentful that people were in their lives doing stuff, and I would just get so angry with them. I would just start yelling at strangers on the streets. It was like this beautiful day, and I peeled myself off the floor. I needed a cigarette so bad, so I had to, like, go out in the sun. It was awful. And I called up my friend, and so she's looking at this meeting. I'm just, like, sweating. I don't know if you guys remember, it was like, ugh. I was sweating like crazy, and all the booze was like just coming out of my pores, and, you know, I don't know how I got to that meeting. I don't know how that happened, you know, and she stayed on the phone with me the whole time, and I showed up, you know, and I thought this was some kind of sick joke, because there's like red Silo cups everywhere on the ground, the whole like campus smelled like booze, you know, it was like after a Saturday night, you know, after graduation, it, you know, I just thought it was a horrible joke, and I showed up, and there was only one person there. And I thought, is this an AA meeting? You know, it's because all I'd known about AA was what I'd seen in movies, and I was horrified to be in an AA meeting. And this very nice man was kind of equally freaked out that I was there, and, you know, but God bless his heart, you know, he stayed there and for about 45 minutes explained to me what AA was, and I didn't have a clue. I didn't know there was a book, you know, I didn't know there was different kinds of meetings. I didn't know, you know, that this had anything to do with anything. You know, my friend said, you're not going to like it, it's religious, you know, and she was wrong. You know, she got me to AA. She doesn't really do AA today. I don't know if she's sober. We are not really in touch, but I'm so grateful that she got me to that first meeting, you know, and, you know, I think so that guy was saying stuff, he's like, you know what I really like about AA is it lets you be the kind of person that you're going to be. So, like, if you're an artist, you can be an artist. And I started getting really paranoid, you know, because that's what I had always wanted to be. I'd gone to art school. I wanted to be an artist. And he said, you know, sometimes you'll hear really scary stuff about, like, people getting into fights. And I was like, oh, my God, how does he know me? This is really scary. I was, like, so freaked out. And I thought he'd been watching me, and, you know, and I'm just, like, not looking good. I think I might have had a black eye, you know. I just looked, you know, and I don't think I was crying, but I think, like, not crying, but just, like, my body was just like, what are you doing, you know, and, you know, I could feel that need to have a drink coming on pretty strong. And he said, you know what, like, it really is women sticking with women, so how about you come to this meeting tonight, and I'll introduce you to some women. And that's all it took, that breadcrumb to get me to that next meeting, you know. And I remember getting through that day was so hard. It was sunny. You know, I had to take the dog out, which meant I had to move my body. And, you know, I must have smoked probably 3 packs of cigarettes that day. And that was a hard day. I just cried a lot. And my friend stayed on the phone with me for quite a bit of time. And I just got to the next meeting. My sponsor was there, even though she wasn't my sponsor at the time. And I remember people were talking about how they used to drink, you know, and I just remember hearing people talk about things like isolation, and I was like, oh, that's weird, I do that, you know, I totally do that. And people would talk about, you know, when they were buying glasses for their home, they would buy big glasses, you know, so that one drink would, like, still just be one drink, but it would be, like, a really big drink. And I was like, that's right, you know, one drink for me was like a pitcher, you know. And I just really identified with some of the things people were talking about. And I thought to myself, all right, well, maybe they're onto something here. I'm going to go to that literature table. I'm going to read up on this thing. You know, I'm going to see, you know, these people seem pretty weird. She's wearing terrible clothes, you know. He looks unhealthy, you know. Like, I remember being real judgmental in that first meeting. And I'm pretty sure I was the sickest person in the room, you know. And people were so gracious to me, and I'd never heard people talk with that kind of honesty, like telling on themselves, you know, and that meant a lot to me. It broke through probably some kind of my ego, I don't know, and, but I definitely didn't feel like I belonged, you know, I wouldn't say that, but there was this, so I go to the literature table, I'm like, I'm just going to read about this, you know, I think I'm going to fill out these questions, and maybe I'll come back, but I really doubt it. And some woman flagged me down and, you know, wanted to talk. And or she said, when was your last drink? And I thought that was the dumbest question I've ever heard, you know. I was like, why would you, what? And I was like, obviously it was last night, you know. And she was, she was like, okay. And you know, and she was like, well, let me give you my phone number, and, you know, I go to the 7 a.m. meeting, and that's, like, tomorrow, so what if I meet you there? And I don't know about you, I'm, like, pretty gullible. I, like, didn't know it was an option to say no, you know? I didn't know it was an option to leave and drink again, you know? I just didn't know. I was pretty paranoid by that time, you know, I was telling you how I was, like, diving behind couches, hiding from people, and, you know, when the phone would ring, I had a job where I would sit in the basement and not have to talk to a soul, and when the phone would ring, I would pick it up and hang it right back up again, and I got by, you know, like, in that job, God bless. And I remember sometimes my boss would look at me and go, are you okay? And I'd be like, what's your problem, you know? And there, you know, I was just, you know, a mess. But so it's another breadcrumb, you know, that woman got me to the next meeting, and that's just kind of how it went for a couple of days. And I didn't know how to sleep, and so I would go to, like, 3 meetings a day. I just kind of felt kind of okay if I would be in a meeting. And I remember one of the first meetings, this woman, she looked at me like, she just looked like a mess, and I was like, I bet she doesn't even know how to, like, talk right, you know, and there she is just, like, pouring out these, like, golden nuggets of spirituality, you know, like, these little, like, fists are, like, you know, and I was, you know, that kind of broke down some of my judgmentalness about, like, how people look in meetings as opposed to, like, what they're saying and if I identify and, you know, just these little experiences. And I don't know, I found something really attractive in AA meetings, and I felt kind of okay, and I found, like, people were really nice to me, and, you know, at this point, I didn't really have many relationships going on. Like I said, my one friend, because she would tolerate me, probably because she was in AA at the time. But, like, for companionship, I would, like, go to the 7-Eleven, you know, and, like, pretend like I was browsing and, you know, try to be in there for some sort of human contact. And the guy one time, he was like, you are so depressed. You are depressing me. Like, please, don't come here, you know? And he was like, I'm going to try to make you smile, but, you know, like, you look really depressed. And I was like, oh, geez, you know, it's 7-Eleven. You know, but that's where I was at, you know? I didn't know how to be around people at that time. So being in AA, people were really nice to me, and that meant a lot to me, you know? I was pretty hostile, pretty rude, you know? But there was something that I found really attractive about AA, and somebody in that very first meeting said to me, why don't you try getting down on your knees to pray as an act of humbling yourself? You know, the nerve. But, you know, you guys, I did that. I was really desperate at that first day, at that first meeting. And so I did that, and I had some sort of sense of calm that allowed me to sleep through the night. And I've been praying every day since. I don't think that's what keeps me sober, you know, but that's been a big part of what I do. And I don't know. You know, it's just these little nuggets that happen in the beginning. And then I had a friend come visit me because her mom was dying. And she came to a meeting with me. Her mom was at the hospital. And she came to a meeting with me, and she was like, you know, they talk a lot about the sponsor thing. You better do that. And I said, but that's for the, you know, those people, you know? And so she really, like, kind of elbowed me up to this girl, and I said, can I talk to you about sponsorship? And she said, all right, I'll be your sponsor. And I was like, that's not what I said, you know? I just want to talk to you about it. And, you know, she met with me for coffee the next day, and she said, why are you here? You know, are you done drinking? And are you willing to do a couple things? You know, and I said, yes, you know. And so she and I started going through the book. At this point, I was going to, like, 3 meetings a day. I didn't know what else to do with myself. I was, like, punching cinder block walls, you know, at work. I just was so, like, my skin was just crawling, you know. I was having a bad reaction to sobriety, that's for sure. And, you know, looking back, like, having that job was such a miracle because it allowed me to, like, go to 3 meetings a day. You know, I would always complain about having these nothing jobs. A, I couldn't handle anything better than a nothing job. And, you know, that really was that job. I'm really grateful for that job now. So, yeah, I got a sponsor. We started working the steps. I got a resentment and fired her, and started working with another lady who would spend time with me talking about my feelings, and, you know, that didn't last very long, and I got another sponsor, and I would kept doing this thing where I would, like, get up to the ninth step and fire them, get up to the ninth step and change sponsors, get up to the ninth step, you know, and that went on for about 2 years, and I started getting really crazy in sobriety. I was like, and I was confused because I was doing everything everybody was telling me to do. You know, I was going to a lot of meetings. I had a sponsor, you know, I had done the steps. Well, no, I hadn't, you know, I had a home group, although I didn't really see the point of it. And, you know, looking back, I think that my sponsor and I were talking on the way up here about having to have that real solid foundation of the first step, you know. And I don't think I had that, so, like, everything that was based on that was shaky, you know? And that I had worked the steps backwards to step one, where I was like, do I really belong here? Am I really an alcoholic? Maybe I overreacted, you know? Because my life was crazy, you know? I felt dead on the inside all over again. I'd gotten into I got a reckless driving ticket, and then a week later I got a speeding ticket. And the things which I said to the court, the officer, which were read aloud in court, were really humiliating. And I didn't get out of those tickets. I paid a lot of money, you know, and I was like, nothing is going my way, you know. Ended a relationship that I'd been in with somebody I really cared about. Everybody seemed to be mad at me, which now when it happens, it's like really, that's a sign to me that I'm not doing something I should be doing, taking care of my side of the street and everything. You know, that's sort of where things ended up in sobriety. And I didn't understand. I was like, but things are supposed to be great. I don't have alcohol in my system, you know. And what I was missing was that second part of the first, well, I didn't have a clear understanding of really the kind of alcoholic that I am, which is, you know, when I take a drink, there were some times when I knew how much I would drink, but not always. There were times when I way overshot it, you know, and thought I had changed my mind. And but that part about when I don't have any alcohol in my system, like, why did I always go back to it, you know? What was that? Why would I go back to it? You know, a lot of bad things happened when I was drinking, and so why couldn't I stay away from it? And I could look back and see, you know, that obsession was pretty strong, and that would lead me back to that first drink time and time again, you know, because I could quit for a year, not towards the end, but, you know, I could quit for a couple of days, or one day at the end, you know, but I couldn't stay away from it, like, for good, and then that whole part about unmanageability, that I really didn't get. I would be like, yeah, it's unmanageable. I know what you mean, you know, and so here I am in sobriety, like, getting all these legal consequences. I was having some physical, stuff going on. My relationships were all terrible, and I thought, AA is not working for me, you know, and I got pretty desperate, and so I got with my current sponsor, who I don't know where I would be without her. You know, and that whole part about the second step, which is like, I'm broken when I'm sober, you know, I'm broken when I'm drunk, and I'm broken when I'm sober, you know, you know, I do not want to be in charge of my life, you know, because when I'm managing my life, I end up in court, you know, I end up making people angry, I end up, you know, having, you know, smoking again, you know, which is something for me, but, you know, and we spent a lot of time. So I got really desperate, and I was terrified of this woman, but I asked her for help, and she helped me, and we spent a lot of time in the first step getting really clear about the physical part, the mental part, the spiritual part. And I'd always heard spiritual malady and didn't really know what people were talking about. You know, but the things that ever drove me to drink in the first place, you know, what does it take me out from behind the bottle, you know? Who am I? Why did I ever drink, you know? And, oh my gosh, we did some serious work, and it seemed like a lot of work, but I'm surprised that I'm just an ordinary drunk, you know, and I need to do some work in this program to stay sober. I thought I was just going to be able to, like, scoot by and not do what you people did and be okay, and it's not the case for me. I need all of it. I need the sponsor. I need the home group. I need the service in the home group. I need meetings, a lot of meetings, and I need the steps in a big way. And, you know, and then we got to that, through all the steps, and in step four, I remember saying, I don't really have any resentments. She was like, I was like, I'm 2 years sober. I don't have any resentments yet. She was like, let's say some prayers. And then this list kind of wrote itself, and it was like 123 people long, you know, and one person had over, like, I don't know, 100 resentments or something. And I was writing that inventory for a long time, and I had this experience, which I'll tell you about, where I went to New Orleans. Somebody gave me a free vacation to New Orleans. I decided to go there to finish my fourth step. Which I wish everybody's like, yeah, we can't believe you did that. That's crazy. And I was like, why didn't anybody tell me? At the time, and I went, and it was awful, you guys. It was like, here I am in this, like, gross hotel room, like, trying to write my fourth step, and I'm like, my ego is not wanting me to, like, uncover this stuff, you know. It is, like, hanging on for dear life, you know. Don't open that book. Don't pick up that pencil. And, oh, that was awful. That was an awful trip. But so I had known some folks down there, and we were out walking around the French Quarter, and there was this guy, and he looked to be my age, and they drag him out of Pat O'Brien's, and unconscious. He'd, like, gotten sick all over himself, and I don't know if you guys have ever been there, but, like, the gutters are full of this, like, stinky green slime, and who knows what it is, and he's, like, laying in this stuff, you know, and it stinks, and it's hot, and he's totally out. You know, and the ambulance is there, and they're sticking all these tubes in them, and they're trying to resuscitate him, and they can't. And I feel, like, self-centered, I guess, a little bit, but I was thinking, you know, this is, like, that could be me, you know. Am I going to do this four-step, or aren't I? You know, that could be me, and that's where I'm headed. You know, that's really what I took out of that, and I got back to writing. And I finished that thing before I touched down on Virginia soil. Well, it was painful. And it took 17 hours to go through. thorough. It was very thorough. I had a lot of resentment. I am a really angry person. And, you know, and then, you know, I wish that these steps were a little easier for me. They're just not. You know, I have a really big ego, and it really is out to get me. And amends have been terrifying to me my whole sobriety, and I had to put that in somebody else's hands, you know, my sponsor. They were killing me. I have just a few that are outstanding. I'll share one experience, maybe two. You know, I told you my sister was, she and I fought like cats and dogs, and I showed up all drunk at her wedding, and it was awful. And so she and I we didn't talk for like 4 or 5 years. I mean, I had just sort of conceded that we were never going to talk again. We weren't going to be friends. That she was a terrible person and I was a nice young lady. And, you know, that took a lot of time. Slow, steady steps. And of me calling her, asking her how she was doing, of me not going on and on about my problems, of, you know, taking an interest in her life, of trying to show her some respect. And, you know, that is a miracle to me that she calls me on her way home from work these days. She had a baby, and I was the first person she called, you know. And she asked me to go up and, like, paint a mural in her baby's room, you know. Like, she has this, like, natural way of respecting me. She's a normal person, you know, that she would pick something that was special to me, like art, you know, and be able to, you know, just, like, really thoughtful stuff. And she's a really good friend of mine today. I really miss her when she's not around, and I never in a million years would have thought that would have happened. And she's got this wonderful baby with some heart problems, you know, and she calls me for help, you know. That's just all AA, you know. When it's me, I show up drunk at her wedding, or I don't call for years, you know. I don't have the power on my own to do that, to be that kind of person. Like, that's all you guys, you know? And that's really special to me today. I was pretty mad at my dad when I came, and I was really scared to tell them I was in AA. And I have a really good relationship with my folks today. I call them on a weekly basis. I'm going to have dinner on Tuesday. You know, I have a really nice home life today with my family. Another amends that happened is my freshman year at college, I had a friend, my best friend slash boyfriend, who committed suicide, and I was there, and it was awful. You know, and that was the kind of experience where after that happened, I learned how to drink alone. You know, nobody wanted to be around me because I didn't know how to deal with that whole thing, and it was pretty awful. But, you know, I hear people say, you know, like, terrible things happen in my life that I don't think I had a part in. Like, how do you make amends? You know, like, how do you get free from that, you know? And for me, I don't know, that whole thing just kind of unfolded itself. I feel like we didn't even really work on it that hard. But, you know, it's like, I can't really let go of the resentment until I make the amends, and then I see how destructive it's been all along. You know, I don't even know when I'm holding on to it, I feel like. And so that was up in Baltimore, and so I was up there visiting some friends recently, and I decided to make this amends, and I didn't even think it was that big of a deal. And I wrote this letter, and I went to his graveside, and it, like, it just kind of, like, came to me, you know, like, why I was in so much bondage over this, you know. It was like a stranglehold on all my relationships, and I didn't even know it. You know, I was always terrified people were going to leave me, so I'd leave them first, and all this stuff. And, you know, really fear of getting close to anybody, you know, all that stuff that I was, like, putting on everybody in my life, you know, that just was kind of as a result of this thing, I think. And, but what was I doing, you know? I was, like, blaming this person for ruining my life. And also, I think I was, like, judging him for so long for having done this thing. But there I am for years trying to find the right tree to drive my car into, you know? Like, and I just got some real freedom from that and going to that gravesite and apologizing for keeping it alive for so long, you know? And some other stuff, too. That was huge. And what the greatest, I was like, okay, yeah, I've made this amends. That was really great for me. And then I went to an AA meeting, like, later that night or the next morning in Baltimore City. And this guy was telling his story, and he tried to commit suicide a number of times. He was talking about how upsetting it was for his family and everything. And then there was this other guy in there, and he's like, my brother tried to commit suicide last night. I was in the hospital room with him, and I came straight to this meeting from there. He's in so much pain. I don't know what to do. You know, and it's like instantly my experience became useful, and I was able to, like, I don't know if I helped them, but I was able to at least share with them my experience and why I was there and what my amends have been like. And, you know, that's, like, one of the greatest gifts in AA is, like, all my experience, all the parts of my life that I thought were bad, or that things that I hate about myself, you know, my character defects and experience that I've had that I find embarrassing, or, you know, whatever, like, things that I'm ashamed of, every single one of them seem to become useful when I can share them with another alcoholic. You know, it's like every part of my life has some kind of purpose here, that AA gives me a purpose. And, you know, and through all this stuff, I feel like I have this trust in this higher power, you know, this God that is so forgiving, because I've seen other people forgive me in amends, you know. That's how I can understand God's forgiveness and love, you know, that my sister would love me like she loves me today, and the love that I can show for my family, like, that's not of me, you know, like, that's just me when I'm, like, in the channel. You know, and God has done so many things for me that I couldn't do for myself, and I just feel like this thing in AA is, like, today is just a gift, you know, and it's just for today. I can't promise, you know, that I'm going to be sober forever. And it's really breathtaking to think of it that way. I don't know why me and why not somebody else. You know, in my short time here, I feel like there's so many people that have walked out the doors and not come back. And why them and not me, you know? It's just a gift. And the work that I do, you know, isn't so that I deserve anything, right? With Joe say that it's like, you know, I do that work to try to get closer to God so that, like, he can use me, you know? And it was scary for me to kind of, like, give up my old life, you know? It was really scary. But this life today is unbelievable. I still really struggle with, like, now that my life is so wonderful, I get really resentful that I have to, like, do all the things that I do in AA, you know? I have that delusion that I'm, like, a normal person, sober. That because I'm sober, I'm like a normal person. It's a delusion, you know? And I get really worked up about that sometimes. I struggle with that today. I struggle with self-pity, you know, when things aren't going my way. I have a job right now where I'm working, like, really, really, really long hours, and it's not enabling me to do the things that I want to do. You know, I get wrapped up in that, but all I have to do is go to an AA meeting, you know, and talk to a new woman. And it's like, oh, you know, this is where I belong. This is where God's chosen me to be useful and all that other stuff, you know, is like a byproduct of what I'm doing in AA. And my home group is so important to me. They call me out when I'm being selfish. I could go on and on, but you know, this group is awesome. I love this home group. I love hearing AA stories because I feel like I can always hear somebody from somebody else that I can connect with, you know, and staying connected in AA is what keeps me grounded here on earth, you know. You know, through the grace of God, I hope I'm here for a little while with you people. Thanks for letting me share.